Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, and this week is no different. But of course, each and every week, we bring you one particular aspect, and that aspect is music history. Because I love history, and I love music, so why not put the two together and do some music history just for you folks? Because I'm one of those people that's weirdly interested in this stuff. And of course, helping me along with this show are my beautiful co-hosts, Jacob Crum.
If I had my druthers, I'd still be here.
And Greg Harvey.
Where's the beef?
Greg is, of course, the best looking amongst us. That's just a statement of fact.
Oh, thanks, guys.
He is a pretty, pretty man.
And if the creek don't rise, you still will be.
So there you go. I would like to say that if you want to help out our show and our weird little crew that we have here, you can go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and on the right-hand side, you'll see an Amazon banner. Click on that banner. It'll take you to Amazon. Nothing different about that page. It's just Amazon. You know, you search for all this stuff. I was on Amazon today. I was looking for a pair of gaming headphones with the mic attached so I could actually like play some games with my friends and stuff so I don't have to use my other microphone that I've been using. But from there, if I were to have purchased said headphones, it would have been shipped to me. And of course, I wouldn't do this because technically I'm not supposed to. But then the show would get a little bit of money back from the purchase that I made. It's that simple. Won't cost anything extra. But that's just how it works. So go to the website, click on the banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Gentlemen, shall we begin this week? And this week, I'm not really sure what to expect from this week, actually, because these are very interesting. So I don't know what we're gonna tap into as far as the conversations go. But we're doing September 25th through September 29th. And hopefully we've got some good stuff here that I think we will have some fun discussions with.
Adventure awaits us.
Yes. So let's start off with September 25th. Jake, kick off the night for us, please.
Sure. All right. 1968. Henry King Stanford banned Dixie at the University of Miami. In a letter printed in the student newspaper, The Hurricane, President Stanford spoke about his concerns over the rising use of Confederate imagery, and he said this: "As a genuine Southerner, one whose family goes back 300 years into the history of the South, I pride myself on the nobler aspects of my Southern heritage, a dignity, a courtesy, a civility, a mannerly approach, of all of which denote a respect for the individual. I confess the Southerners have not always lived up to this heritage, but at least the tradition is there." Further on, he said, "Yet it is this very aspect of my Southern heritage that persuades me to believe it is not honorable to force upon a minority group the symbols of the Confederacy, which, rightly or wrongly, have become so distasteful to them. Symbols which are associated in their minds with slavery, discrimination, and the degradation of human personality."
Wow.
End quote.
So in 1968, he had the vision.
Yes.
To ban Confederate songs and images because he knew that minorities might be offended by them. Wow. Wow.
Is it bad that like the first thing I got hung up on was, you know, that his family has been in the South for 300 years? And I was like, but that was before our nation was actually there.
I mean, I don't look. I didn't look into the genealogy of Stanford.
But it's just that's where my mind first
fair
went.
Enough.
So
great great grandpa was Ponce de Leon.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty solid Southern accent, though.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you, sir.
I thought that was good.
That was pretty Georgian. So
secretly, that is the only reason I put this in the notes. No, I'm kidding. I knew I was going to do that.
It is fascinating, though, and I know I was talking about this before. That the song Dixie is actually a very old song.
Mm-hmm.
It goes well before like the concept of Dixie or Dixieland, and it was actually a spiritual before that, and it wasn't Dixie. It was supposed to be Canaan. which is I thought was kind of a funny thing. But the song is very old before it even became Dixie.
Yeah.
And then it got changed as a lot of things happened back then. You know, they took a melody of something and then just changed the words around, and then it became a new song. So then it became Dixie, of which the entire reason as to why it became, associated with the Confederacy was because it was just popular in the South during the Confederacy. But you also like, you hear about Dixie and stuff, like, you know, Dixie was banned. You don't hear the Bonnie Blue Flag being banned ever, and yet that was a song that was equally as popular as Dixie. It's just that Dixie stuck around because it would always got into people's heads.
Right. And also, it's notable to say that he didn't ban the singing of Dixie on campus by people. He just banned it as a song, like, at events that the school band would play, like for a pep rally or whatever. But Brian, it's the same thing. People still struggle today with Wagner's music because it's so closely, it was so usurped and used by
the Nazis.
Yeah, and the brown shirts even before then.
Yes. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's, and actually Dixie was written by a Northerner, so, makes me laugh even more. So all of that and more can be found out on Ken Burns' Civil War documentary. He actually goes into a good bit about the songs that were popular in that day and age, including Battle Hymn of the Republic and Bonnie Blue Flag and all the rest of them. So Bonnie Blue Flag is always a funny song because it actually, I mean, it completely totally references, like, the South and states' rights and, like, all. It was basically written just for the Confederacy. Yeah, so, but there you go. Let's go ahead and move on. 1967. I will go ahead and take this one, Jake, because I like this one a lot.
You know, you can count me out until the last story of this day if you want.
Okay. So, 1967. Dolly Parton makes her first appearance and television debut on the Porter Wagoner Show. She stayed on the show for 7 years, and after her famous departure, she continued to record with Wagoner. And from 1968 to 1980, Porter and Dolly recorded 13 albums. Now, of course, do you know what song it was that she first, like, went out on her own with?
It was I Will Always Love You.
I Will Always Love You. And she played it for Porter Wagoner, and he was like, I can't take that song. It's like, you have to do that. Like, it's like, I'm not stealing that one from you. But yeah, she always made a big impact whenever she first showed up on the Porter Wagoner Show. And of course, Porter Wagoner being super huge in country music, I think a lot of people who aren't into country music don't understand exactly how huge he was for just the television show alone. It's like, but the fact that he made all of these albums just is exceptionally cool. So there you go. Dolly Parton, 1967, really makes her debut to the rest of the world.
And also, I think, like, every single one of those albums cracked, like, the country music, like, top 10.
Yeah.
Like, all but one.
I wouldn't doubt it at all. So they were like a power duo back in the day. So makes a lot of sense because he had kind of like a lower voice and she had her, you know, high voice. And so they blended very well together.
Well, I mean, Dolly's got a crazy range, though, anyway.
Yeah, she does.
She's like a counter alto.
Yeah. So I think the next one Greg should do.
Yeah. So on the same day that Henry King Stanfer was banning Dixie, we also had a celebrity birthday on 68.
Yes.
Will Smith in West Philadelphia, born and raised. On the playground is where he spent most of his days. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was born. Happy birthday, Will Smith.
Yes.
So now, of course, Will Smith has become quite famous for acting and all of that. He hasn't done a whole lot of music recently, though.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
It was before. It's like he basically released songs like that associated with the movies that he did.
Yeah. I mean, like Summertime was his first, you know, huge hit.
Yes, with everything.
And then, of course, the Fresh Prince theme.
Yeah.
And then he went on to be Will Smith solo, and we had such hits as Miami and Getting Jiggy With It.
Yes.
So.
And then you also had, like, the other stuff later on, like Wild Wild West.
Oh, yeah. Wicked Wild Wild West.
Which I think was the
and
most...
And Men in Black as well.
Yeah. Here come the Men in Black.
I think, and I could be wrong about this, that the Wild West performance at the MTV Music Video Awards, right? I think that's still the most expensive performance production that they've ever done.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I don't like know. Per segment.
I'd have to go back and watch that one. I don't think I remember it.
When adjusted for inflation.
He had something like 180 dancers.
Oh, wow.
For that. For that 4 minutes, 3 minutes.
Did they all like climb up on each other's shoulders and become like the big robot thing?
They became a super dancer.
Yeah.
With our powers combined, we become... No, that's funny. So I think it's more hilarious to me that kids these days don't even remember that he actually had a music career.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, yeah.
They're like, Will Smith, the actor. It's like, well, he was a rapper, and then he was an actor, and then he's just sort of stuck with the acting.
Well, we can say the same thing about, you know, Ice Cube and Ice-T.
That is true.
And all kinds of guys.
It's like kind of funny you bring that up, actually, because over the last week or so, I've actually been listening to... Well, one, I saw Will Smith's like last movie that was like came out, Collateral Beauty, which was really good. I loved that movie, actually. But then I was also checking out Ice-T's like metal band that is out now.
Body Count.
Body Count. And like that was just crazy awesome. Like I was loving that stuff. So I don't even care if he got a little preachy in some of his songs, but it was still just like, oh man, this is just some good music.
Yeah, well, yeah. I guess Body Count's been around since like the '90s, but they did just drop a new album recently too. So
yeah,
their like big single is "No Lives Matter."
Yes, I watched that one.
Some people say Black Lives Matter. Some people say White Lives Matter. Some people say All Lives Matter. Well, I'm here to tell you, no lives matter.
So the line at the end of the chorus, when it comes to the poor, no life matters.
Yeah.
And what it is that it's basically talking about the government or the cops and stuff like that, picking on those that don't have power as opposed to, you know, the rich people who do have power. So
you don't see them pulling over white people and dragging them out of their cars because they got lawyers. They'll sue your ass.
Yep. So there you go.
So Will Smith's last album was 2005.
Yeah. That was a good while ago.
And of course,
I think it's about time that
I think
he came out with another one.
Really?
Yeah. He could do something really good.
Don't some of his kids have albums?
Yeah.
Or did some,
Willow Smith had, I whip my hair back and
that's
forth.
Right, that's right, that's right.
And I think Jaden does like some rapping.
Yeah.
Jaden's kind of a little bit into everything.
Jaden's trying to be a renaissance man.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess Will kind of got close to that. But
there's a fun segment. One of my favorite radio shows I listen to, they do a fun segment where they take Jaden Smith tweets and they compare them to like famous philosophers, you know, like not like a philosopher like Plato, but like Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
You know, like people who were kind of out there. And so there'd be a tweet and they'd read it and it'd be like, we are all just dust in the eye of the Lord, you know, and then they'd read another one and they'd be like, these drugs really got me messed up. And they'd be like, which one?
Which one is Jaden Smith?
Which one is Jaden Smith? And which one is, you know, legendary rock star Jason Bonham?
My favorite celebrity Twitter association has got to be the Twitter where they take Kanye West tweets and do them in the form of Tracy Morgan's character from 30 Rock.
Yeah.
And basically, they just add Liz Lemon to the beginning of every sentence, and it's just hilarious.
Liz Lemon, am I the greatest of all time? I believe so.
It's like, Liz Lemon, where can I get a marble conference table? It's like, I want to have conferences, but I need a table.
Oh,
that's
man.
An actual tweet from Kanye West. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Wow.
All right, let's go ahead and move on. 1980 for September 25th, John Bonham, drummer for Led Zeppelin, died at the age of 32 after a heavy drinking session. Bonzo was found dead at guitarist Jimmy Page's house of what was described as asphyxiation after inhaling his own vomit after excessive vodka consumption. 40 shots in 4 hours.
Blech. Gross.
During live sets, his drum solo, Moby Dick, would often last half an hour, and regularly feature use of his bare hands. In 2007, though, to commemorate the life of John Bonham, Ludwig issued a limited edition drum kit in Bonham's memory.
Let me just say that Ludwig kit is cool, too. That's that amber. It's like they made that amber kit with a huge bass drum.
Yeah.
That's a good drum kit.
So you know what I always liked about Bonham, though, was that he matched the songs so well. And it was, you know, you can talk about his skill. You can talk about, you know, the drum solos that he did. You know, it's like how good he actually was. But when it came to finding the beat that matches what Jimmy Page was playing or what Robert Plant was singing, John Bonham was like the king of that. Nobody else could have done what he actually did for that band.
I think being a drummer for a band that would sometimes get so spacey, especially for their time, like I totally get what you're saying, because I'm thinking of some of those breakdowns, you know, where it is. The whole song falls apart and the drums are just the only thing keeping it together. But even he is kind of doing something weird.
I mean, you look at it, though. What was it? Kashmir, right? It's this really, really straightforward drum beat in the very beginning. It's like, yeah, everybody remembers the guitar part, but without that very stupid, simple drum beat with the echo, it's like the song's just going to completely fall apart. He knew exactly what that song needed.
Wow, that's good stuff.
Yep.
It's kind of a shame that he partied himself to death.
Yes, he did. Well, this should just tell you something. Never do 40 shots of vodka in 4 hours.
Yeah, that's highly recommended against.
Yep. All right. So I got another one here, actually. Another drummer. So 10 years after John Bonham dies, Dave Grohl actually auditioned for Nirvana and got the gig. Right off the bat, from what I understand. Basically, he showed up, played for them, and they were like, "You're in!" And he's like, "Cool, let's do this."
Sweet.
I think it was actually more like, "Hey, that was great. Let's go get a beer. You're in."
Yeah. So Dave Grohl joined Nirvana after the sudden breakup of Grohl's former band, Scream. His friend Buzz Osborne of the Melvins gave Dave the phone number of Chris Novoselic. Right? That's Novoselic. Mm-hmm. After talking to Chris and Kurt, Dave was invited to audition in Seattle. After less than 3 jam sessions, Dave joined Nirvana full time.
That's awesome.
So that's the other thing, too. That Dave Grohl fit Nirvana very well because he knew exactly what he wanted. He knew exactly what the songs needed.
Mm-hmm.
And he always talked about it that, like, you know, it was never really said that they didn't want, like, a lot of, like, fills and stuff in the music, because there's really not a lot of fills in the songs. But he was just like, well, that's just what the songs require. They didn't need anything that was, like, you know, frivolous, you know, this just extra stuff thrown in there. He's like, they just needed the right beat for the right song.
Yeah, it's...
And then, you know, of course, now later on with the Foo Fighters, he gets to do whatever he wants, you know, because he's got the other guy doing drums and...
Yeah, Dave Grohl, such a fantastic drummer. I love the fact, too, that he's one of those drummers who he branches out constantly to do other projects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his stuff with Tenacious D is probably one of my favorite. Not only that, but he busts out some drum beats for Tenacious D that he doesn't ever bust out in a lot of his other music because he gets to get heavier.
He gets to play the metal.
And so it's really fun to admire that. I heard that the Foo Fighters' first album... Because, of course, they have a drummer, Taylor Hawkins, right?
Yes.
Foo Fighters have a drummer, but apparently the first Foo Fighters album, Dave recorded...
Pretty much everything
for it, and then Taylor just had to come in and kind of learn the songs.
Yeah, at least for the first one. Now he does all the rest of
and
it.
And now he does the rest, yep, correct.
But, it cracks me up because that first album, Dave actually said... After he got it done and he was like, all right, I'm going to put this out there. Let's see if anybody actually cares about what the drummer for Nirvana is currently doing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like he said he had that moment of like, isn't everybody just going to think like, oh, he's the drummer. Like, what can he actually do?
Mm.
And instead he produced one of the greatest rock albums of that era.
We're very lucky that he was just able to push forward and do his thing.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
He had a major... He had major industry behind him, though. Like,
to promote the album, yes. Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, if it had sucked...
Well, true. That's true.
you know.
Fair enough.
He did have some heavy publicity behind Kurt's death.
Oh, yeah.
Death.
I mean, look at Ringo's band. I mean, yeah, it's Ringo's band, but, you know, and he gets stuff on tours. I was like, but I can't name you one frickin' hit that he's done, like, from that group, so.
Ringo?
Yeah.
I know that one where he goes, no, 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 I don't it no more. I'm tired of waking up on the floor. No, thank you, please. It only makes me sneeze. Then it makes it hard to find the door.
So there you go. That's just one of those things. Like Dave Grohl actually had no idea if the song was or if the album was going to be any good, that people were going to like it. But he was happy with it, which is something, you know. I'd say if you're happy with your own art, then you've done something well. Because usually the artists are their harshest critics. So, but let's go ahead and move on. We're going to jump another decade. Greg, go ahead and do this short one for me.
The year 2001, technology reaches its pinnacle as XM radio goes live with a cut from Bob Marley. Beamed into your radio from outer space and beyond the grave.
So we could talk about Bob Marley if we wanted to, but we probably don't.
Well, we talked about him last week, too. So
yeah, what we probably want to talk about is, so, yeah, satellite radio, right? Seemed like a promising thing, like, in the 90s, okay? And then it took a long time for people to get enough capital to actually do it. And so for a while, there were two companies that were satellite radio, right? Mm-hmm. Sirius and XM.
Yep.
And now they're the same entity.
Yep.
So, does satellite radio die with SiriusXM?
Who knows? I have SiriusXM in my vehicle.
I did have it when I got my car, and then I didn't renew it.
I pay for it currently. I do like it. I mean, you got to keep in mind, most of it's commercial free.
Right.
It's all uncensored. Uh-huh. You know, I'm trying to name things that set it apart. You know,
yeah,
the
fair
pros
enough,
here.
Fair enough.
Because, of course, one of the cons, though, is that it is a subscription service, mm-hmm. which typically people aren't used to paying
for what they get for free.
For radio, plus with so much internet radio that's commercial-free as well, right. That's typically free like Pandora.
That's kind of where I'm going with this. Like, okay, so, you know, in 2001, there was not the bandwidth on just sheer data that you could transmit through the internet that there is now.
So this was superior at the time.
Right.
Heck, there's barely enough bandwidth right now, and it's getting worse. But continue.
So I'm just saying, like, is this even still a viable form of media, or will it be in 10 years?
Well, I know for me, one of the big perks about the satellite radio is doing a lot of traveling and being able to just set it on one station and listen.
Yeah.
You know, I always think back, because about a month before I got satellite radio, I drove across the country from central Illinois to Vegas and back. And in the middle of the desert, there's no radio stations and there's nothing to.
And it's true.
You know, you can like plug in your MP3 player or this and that. But, you know, I had an old enough car that it didn't have like an auxiliary input to just play my own music. And
no cassette deck?
Well, no.
None of the cassette that you can stick in?
Well, I had a CD player. But the moral of the story, though, is like, as soon as I got satellite radio, the first thing I thought was that it would have been so great to just put on music I want and just drive and drive and drive and drive and just listen to all their programming instead of getting any dead spots or this or that. I mean, it's satellite. So even to this day, I mean, you know, northern Minnesota, same thing.
Yeah,
you know, I'll go up there a lot and there's, you know, you can get satellite radio wherever you go. So that was one of the big pluses. And the uncensored programming that they have also is pretty appealing as well.
Yeah,
to me. And you know, they branch out, because they are a subscription service. They branch out of genres that, you know, me working in terrestrial radio, Brian, you as well.
Yep.
I remember when the radio station would announce, hey, we're adding a new station, which is such a big deal when you work for a cluster, that you're not flipping a format, you're adding a whole new station. And it was always, almost always, a country station. And we would say, oh, you know, it'd be great if we got a rap station, you know, a hip-hop station, urban station, something that would play like rap and R&B and stuff. And or you know, it'd be great if we got an alternative rock station.
Yeah.
And those never happened, and it was because it was all about money and numbers and audience and this and that. But with satellite radio, even if you have a small demographic, you just air the content and
that was one of the biggest appeals, was I could hear stuff that I couldn't hear anywhere else. And even if I was the only person who wanted to hear it, at least they were playing it somewhere for me.
So. Yeah. I think it's just, it's taken this long to kind of get up to like the level that it's at. I know, like, because, you know, when you start out something big, like, you expect it to kind of take off and do all of that. But you run into the same problem that when cable was first announced, everybody was like, why would people pay for something that they get for free now?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Pay for channels instead of just broadcast.
And it took a good while for that to build up to what it is, you know. And then, but at the same time, I mean, like, cable numbers still aren't what they are for normal television. Everybody talks about, like, HBO and stuff. You know, Game of Thrones is, like, the most watched show, apparently. And yet, like, their rating stuff is, like, between 13 and 15 million or something sometimes per episode. Which is, like, nothing compared to, like, what MASH got, like, back in the day.
Yeah, okay, but like, that's a little bit... you had no... I mean... choices of like three things to watch.
Yeah,
we have its final episode.
I'm just saying, but like, CBS still. I mean, CBS television, like, they dominate some of those nights. I mean, they just get so many viewers and stuff, like, on an average basis that cable just can't compete with. But, you know, cable does their thing, and when I say cable, I mean, I don't mean just cable. I mean, you know, DirecTV, U-verse, like, all that kind of stuff.
Well,
I don't even think U-verse is around anymore. I think it's just switched over to something else now. But you know, it for Sirius XM, it's exactly what he's talking about. It's the fact that you can basically just put it on a station, and then, you know, you've got precisely this genre of music that you know you want to listen to. You know, or whatever it is that you want, you can find it, because there's like 160 something stations, like, right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of funny just how it all plays out like that. So
I do like, I'll add one last thing about satellite radio, because, well, the comparison to cable is almost completely lateral, where it is, you know, that concept of you get broadcast channels, you can watch a lot of stuff that everybody kind of watches for free on broadcast channels, but then when you have specific type of things like home improvement, you know, or fashion or entertainment, then you have specific audiences and specific channels for that, and that's how the XM radio is too. But what I was gonna say as my last point for the satellite radio, and I kind of lost it there, was you know,
Greg's lost it.
I did.
And we're going to leave you out to dry, too.
I feel like it was a decent point that I was going to make about satellite radio.
Well, okay, hold on to that then while I counterpoint what you've just brought up. Okay. So, all right, so at least in the U.S., we're talking about one provider of satellite radio, and the cost being crazy prohibitive of anyone else just jumping in the market willy-nilly, right? Like, Sony's not going to go like, hey, let's just branch into this other media form over here.
Yeah, well, I mean, anything dealing with satellites is going to be, you know, more difficult to do. Just because. That's just how it is.
Well, like, all right, I'm looking at, like, a Wikipedia article, and, like, just the FDA, just the license to put satellites in space for this was almost $100 million.
Yeah.
You know? We're not even talking, like, on-the-ground cost of actually putting satellites in the air. We're not talking about, like, buying... programming to put on the radio station.
But let's not forget exactly why satellite radio was originally created. And that was to get around government bureaucracy known as the FCC.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And I can appreciate that.
That's why Howard Stern moved to satellite radio.
However, the thing is that we're talking about one provider that's still a corporate entity that still has its own set of standards and practices.
True. But it's a corporation. And those standards and practices can change.
Fair enough. I'm not saying it's not a better format to be in. I'm just saying, like, to me, it seems like it's hard to compete with just the internet.
That is true. Streaming is such a huge thing now, too. So, it just kind of makes sense that they can... I'm pretty sure you can get XM radio on your computer and stuff.
Probably.
Now. So, I mean, I think they just stream it.
Yeah. They do. You'd have to pay for that, too, though. Okay, I remembered my my two last points about XM radio.
Go
and,
for
and
it.
And then we can move on.
Thank God.
The good thing was, I remember another great reason why I like satellite radio is that if there's something that I'm trying to listen to, I probably can. And that's huge. So I can be in the middle of the Utah desert, but I wanted to listen to the Green Bay Packers game on the radio, and I was fully confident that I would find it on the radio because I have satellite radio. That's pretty cool. And the other one, which was an interesting point made to me the other day, was that satellite radio, what is their overhead? Because the equipment they use to broadcast is probably some of the most expensive in the world, a.k.a. satellite dishes.
Yes.
And they're also satellite dishes, to an extent, are becoming, I wouldn't say obsolete, but a lot of them are getting old.
Yeah.
And they will need to be either replaced or they're going to be, you know, pushed out for the next, you know, satellite 3.0 or whatever is going to be after that. Well, so the question is satellite radio going to continue to make the investments and work with, you know, space? I mean, just the fact that you have to put satellites in space or at least, you know, rent.
Well, yeah, yeah.
The satellites.
Renting the bandwidth is like the harder part to do. But it's one of those things where if you once you're sending it up there, once you're sending the signal up there and it's being just bounced back to terra firma, then, you know, that, I mean, it's not like cars need satellite dishes to do that. I mean, it's just, you know, it's, you've got to have one centralized location that is actually beaming up this signal to whatever point it happens to be. And then, you know, if you've got a geo-locked satellite, then it's pretty easy to do. But if not, then you've got to have multiple satellites, and then you got to relay some stuff, and I mean, it turns into this whole other thing. But frankly, I mean, as technology progresses, obviously it's going to be easier and easier to put stuff into space. So therefore, it's, you know, you just wait. Elon Musk's going to figure out like everything.
Yeah,
maybe
he will be our savior one day.
Maybe it's,
or he'll create Skynet.
No, he's deathly like terrified of AI taking over.
Didn't say he would do it on purpose. I didn't say he'd be nefarious in it. He could accidentally create.
He's not
Skynet.
Working on programming. He's working on like actual practical technologies.
And that's why it
and that's why Terminators will rise. Well, let's go ahead and move on. I think that we've talked about XM radio enough.
Yeah, only the future can tell.
Except, though, satellite radio, we might be dumping on it.
Yeah.
But for all we know, maybe it's just not really, like, risen yet. Maybe it's not really.
No, I mean, like, the smartest thing that they did, of course, was getting everything in put into cars. But at the same time, HD radios were also installed in cars. Because my car is technically an HD radio as well. And so that was like the competing thing that they were trying to do, is that terrestrial radio was like, you're like, don't worry, guys, we can have better signals. You don't have to leave us. And so, you know, it's like now it's competing technologies, but in the same vehicle. If I wanted to get satellite radio, I could. I've got technically HD radio in the car as well. And it's just like, all right, you know, we'll just work from here.
And then you have great podcasts competing against all of that,
which are now being capable of searching and downloading into your car.
Yeah, the cars are being built.
If you have a Tesla and you're and like you can listen to our show, like you can search for Follow the Sound podcast and you will find it, and you can download our show onto your Tesla.
And you should.
And then listen to it. That's crazy to me. And that's the technology. I mean, that's moving forward. So I like that. Jake, you know, please continue on. I'm tired of talking about this.
You know what else
We've
is crazy?
We've spent like this next 15 story. Minutes on XM radio, and we shouldn't have.
Next
I'm sorry,
story
people.
That's so crazy. Here it goes.
Go for it, Jake.
Okay, so it's time for another installment of Weird Shit That's Happened to Stevie Wonder.
Weird Shit That's Happened to Stevie Wonder.
Thank you. We need a...
A soundboard?
Yeah.
For.
All right, so in 2012, Stevie Wonder... in 2012, Stevie Wonder was approached by some crazy people who attempted to blackmail him. And on this day in 2012, they were found guilty and sentenced. So Alpha Lorenzo Walker and his girlfriend, Tamara Diaz, were sentenced to 292 days served and 3 years probation. Walker had approached Wonder's attorney, Ian Wallach, and showed him a video of Walker breaking into Stevie Wonder's deceased mother, Lula Mae's home. Walker believed that the dilapidated condition of Lula's home was an embarrassment to the blind musician. He also claimed that he was the long-lost nephew of Wonder. And he also claimed that he was related to Jay-Z and Kanye West and a slew of other celebrities. But in addition to the jail time and probation, the judge also ordered Walker to participate in a program for mental health. So what is it about Stevie Wonder that attracts so many bizarre and crazy people? Like, can't they just leave this man alone?
I don't know. That's all I got.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to know, Walker or Wonder's attorney played it really well, right? So Walker was like, we need like $5 million. And he was like, well, how about like $500,000? And he's like, all right, maybe for like $1 million. And then Ian is like, okay, sure, we can do that. However, come back tomorrow so I can record our conversation and just make it official.
Nice.
And then after that conversation the next day, he contacted the FBI, and that was pretty much the end of the investigation.
It was bad because at first I had to go back and like reread the note there because yes. said he approached Wonder's attorney
yes.
and then showed him a video. And my first thought, I had to reread it again because I thought that he approached Wonder and showed him a video. And I was like, that's kind of pointless. I mean, I guess he could hear the video, but it right. wouldn't really matter like what he was seeing. So having to describe it to Stevie Wonder. And this is where my girlfriend is breaking into your dead mother's home. Okay. Let's go ahead and move on. I'm going to do this one because I like this one. September 26th. 1908, the first advertisement, as we Americans like to say it, for Edison's phonograph appears in the Saturday Evening Post. Now, I am one of these guys. I love, like, the history of music technology. Yes. And the phonograph, of course, is like the original recording device. There is something that predates it, which basically used a membrane of some kind and a stiff hog's hair.
Yeah.
Which, when you spoke into it, vibrated and would scratch like along a paper. And they actually recently did digital reconstruction of one of those to recreate the sound
yeah.
of what actually turned out to be a child's voice singing a song as it vibrated against the paper. Super cool.
Why,
I love that.
Why are all the old recordings of everything really creepy?
No, but it was actually really cool.
It's a child singing. Like, somebody was like, let's record this child singing.
Well, because
singing.
It was a goofy little thing to do, and you had a little piece of paper that was like all these little squiggly lines.
100 years later, someone will find this and hear a child's laughter faintly through a hog's hair.
They just thought it was kind of goofy. So, because it was just a piece of paper with, like, the scratchings on it.
They didn't know it was going to be so creepy.
So, okay, so the phonograph was created, which used wax cylinders. So, and the original recordings, you basically had a long tube
yeah.
that you would play or sing into, and it would vibrate against the wax cylinder as it was spinning and then create.
Well, it has a membrane that was yes. attached to a steel needle.
Yes, which would then actually create yeah. the grooves and stuff like that. And then that's what was played back again. It was very hard to actually like duplicate these.
Yes.
And so like in the original days, they basically had to like record like a ton of them. And like, so they'd have bands just like playing the same song over and over again and recording the same thing like onto wax cylinders because it's hard to duplicate them. So here's what actually happened with Edison's phonographs is that he was like, this is the greatest thing. It you know, frickin' invents this insanely popular thing and everybody's going crazy with it. But what it was is that he controlled the content,
uh-huh.
and he controlled like that form of recording technology, which he held to be superior to anything else that might be there. So what happened was everybody had these penny arcades where they would go. They'd put in a song, or they'd put like a penny in, and then they would listen to a song. And he controlled all of the songs that were on there, so he put on the songs he wanted to listen to. Mind you, he was going deaf later on in life, too. But he completely thought that the music he liked is the music that everyone else should like, and that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
So nobody kept like listening to his stuff after sort of the novelty wore off. Plus, the wax cylinders had a tendency to break or, you know, other problems and stuff like that. They were hard to duplicate. And so after that, another company created the shellac record,
yes,
which was a pressed disc, much easier to duplicate. And then later on, of course, pressed vinyl became the new thing. But it was because of those discs with like RCA Victrola that, you know, then completely put phonograph out of business. But I have heard some of these wax cylinders before, and there are actually companies that will produce wax cylinders.
Yes.
So I think you get like 3 minutes of recording time on a cylinder.
Wow. I'm still just impressed with the fact that even back in 1908, people felt that their taste in music was superior to others' taste in music.
Well, that's sort of the amazing thing about it, is that for the first time ever, music was able to be recorded and then given to somebody else.
Yeah.
And so, it was like magic. The only way that you could have music before would be to buy a book that had the songs in there and then play the piano or the instrument that it happened to be, of which just it happened to be pianos were more common than like your average guitar and stuff like that, because guitar string technology hadn't stepped up yet. But pianos were easier, apparently. So it was just funny because they, you know, you would actually like go to these places like that, they, you know, like Tin Pan Alley, where there would be people and their entire job was just to play songs from a particular book. And then people would walk by, listen to what was being played and be like, oh, that sounds nice. I'll buy that book. And so they would then buy the sheet music for that song and then play it back. And, you know, that's how all that stuff happened. And then the second it becomes an actual thing that you can record and give to somebody else, completely changed the game. And we, to this day, cannot imagine a world where we can't listen to music.
Oh, yeah.
Everything before then had to be played live. Everything.
That world would suck.
So you didn't have, like, your favorite song was literally whatever, or the most favorite song in the country was literally whatever the most popular sheet music was.
And not only that, but you had, like, preferences. Like, I like it when Jimmy plays it. Like, Jimmy's version is my favorite. Yeah, you know, like, Jimmy plays it the way I like to hear it.
Yeah, and it's kind of no wonder to me. It might shock someone else who hasn't, like, kind of thought through it that really, up until actual like AM radio began being transmitted, sheet music still outsold recorded music.
Yeah,
you know. But when you think about the lo-fi equipment of the days, why would you the proliferation of musicians that were willing to be rented out to play music? Why would you want to like play like some really kind of shitty sounding pre-recorded thing that lasted exactly long as it did, that you had no input on, as opposed to like getting a musician and be like, hey, can you do like two bars before you go into this hook and then kind of stretch this out for a little while?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that still holds true today to an extent. The only difference is now they put out like extended mixes and, you know, like dance versions and stuff. So I guess if there was the version you needed, compared to just asking the person like, hey, can you stretch it out or play it slower, you know, so we can dance to it or something.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, if you could get, like, a 3- or 4-piece band to show up and play your barbecue or cotillion or dance hall, whatever it was, you know, your daughter's 14th birthday party, as opposed to, like, playing something on a Victrola.
Mm.
Like, you'd probably go for the live band at the time.
Yeah, that
without a second thought.
That'd be more exciting, too, anyways. Yeah. Well, thank goodness we've come so far. Now we just have MP3s and digital music, and I can put an entire album on not even a tiny little fraction of a thumb drive. You know, and you can put an entire album on like a thumb drive.
It's worse than that. You can put entire libraries of genres onto a thumb drive now.
Now you can just stream them out of thin air.
I would like every recorded Tuvan Throat song, you know, since the advent of recording. Yep, I can do that. I can put that. That's going to be like, you know, less than a gig.
New Zealand sheep herding music on demand. Boom.
Oh, moving these sheep from here to there.
Speaking of yodeling,
we got a sheep here.
Yeah, speaking of yodeling, let's talk about early country music. Because in 1925, country music legend Marty Robbins was born Marty Davis Robinson in Glendale, Arizona. Though Marty loved his country music, he considered it more of a career than a passion. His hobby was NASCAR racing.
Of course it was.
He would race as often as he could and entered the Big Two, which is Talladega and Daytona, for more than a decade. When Marty passed in 1982, the notches on his hitching post counted 52 studio albums, 17 number one hits, and 6 top 10 NASCAR finishes. However, to me, the most impressive thing about Marty Robbins is that he got rednecks everywhere to cheer for his race car, which was a two-toned magenta and chartreuse 72 Dodge Charger.
That makes perfect sense.
That's awesome. I mean, if
chartreuse is a funny color.
Yeah, which actually I'm kind of lying, because if you talk to any NASCAR fan, you're like, tell me about Marty Robbins' NASCAR career. They're like, he wasn't any good.
Well... And just I think it goes to show too that, you know, you have your day job and then you have your hobbies, and he was lucky enough that he had a day job that could certainly fund an expensive hobby.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it wasn't that expensive then. Like stock car racing, you could literally just go down to the Ford dealership and say, like, hey, a month from now, I want you to get me a car that has nothing on it. Just engine and a body and one seat, and then drive it to a track and pay your entry fee, and now you're a NASCAR driver.
I mean, I guess so, but I feel like there's probably a lot more cost associated than that, I would think. Even just gasoline, I don't know.
Yeah.
My point is, I don't think your average person I guess on a smaller level, people do that on a local level, but I don't see people NASCAR racing on a whim, you know?
Not necessarily a whim, but before, when the race would move from place to place, there were fewer people that traveled and more locals.
So it was easier to get on the closer race.
Like I said, they call it stock car racing now, and there's nothing stock about these vehicles whatsoever.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They have to produce at least 100 of that car for it to be considered stock.
But even then, I mean, the body's made out of fiberglass. It's got an airfoil on it.
Which is also funny because it has to weigh the same as a regular car.
Right.
Which is why they put the giant, like, basically cast iron V8 in there.
Right.
Well, if you can put it towards stuff that makes it go fast.
Right. Whereas back in the day, you could go and you could buy a 72 Dodge Charger that just had the big engine in it and kind of be competitive. You had a chance.
You might have installed a roll cage or something, but
that's classic. Pull it off the lot.
Not until like the 80s, man.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is kind of impressive because Marty Robbins like crashed like 10 of his NASCARs and like survived. So
wow.
Oh. Anyway,
let's go ahead and move on to 1975.
Yeah.
Let's see. The Rocky Horror Picture Show opens in theaters. As has been said before, the film was a box office flop.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cared to see this movie. But perhaps it was the memorable performances on the film that made it a cult hit before the home video era. But the truth is, Rocky Horror is an experience rather than just a film.
I think this is something that we need more of in today's culture, is you need films that just die flat on their face in the theaters, and people say, you know what? We're going to go back and we're going to see this film every year, but we're going to make up a bunch of goofy stuff that has nothing to do with the film, which, as you say, makes an experience, and now it's like... You know, what's watching the Rocky Horror Picture Show without, like, some of the shenanigans that everybody knows that is associated with it?
Yes, completely, totally agree. It's, you know, here in St. Louis, we have a theater known as the Tivoli. The Tivoli is basically like one of the art house theaters in St. Louis. I'd say there's two. There's the Tivoli and then there's the High Point. And then I guess Plaza Frontenac does more the indie films as well. But every year around a particular Halloweenish type time, they show a midnight showing of Rocky Horror and everyone shows up dressed up, ready to go with all their little props and stuff like that. And it is just a hoot.
A toast. Toast. And you throw toast at the screen.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that's great. Of course, here in St. Louis, we also have the same thing with Tommy Wiseau's The Room, of which the director actually shows up to talk before the film and stuff, which just is even better.
A friend of mine who is a journalist.
Yes.
Actually just posted not that long ago posted a picture on Facebook. She met Tommy Wiseau in the parking lot when he was in town at the show.
Yes.
Right. And she said that she didn't ask to take a picture with him. He just like walked up and gave her a present, which was actually like a spoon in a box. Like a little present. It's a thing in the show.
Okay.
Like randomly, there's a picture of a spoon, like on a desk.
Yes.
Just in the background of the film, and it's really kind of bizarre because you're like, where, who,
why is there a spoon?
Yeah. So people throw plastic spoons at the screen during the viewing. Yes, anyhow,
that's right.
Yeah, so he gives her a spoon in a box that's like wrapped up like a present and says like tells her like, so this represents like the all the aspects of life, and then says take a picture, so that she takes a picture, and then he goes okay, bye bye. And that was meeting Tommy Wiseau. By the way, she was just outside the theater like smoking. He didn't even know she was attending the movie. Right? I mean, every aspect of this man's life is a story, is what I'm saying. Like, everything.
Hence why it is being converted into a film starring the Franco brothers.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yes. So.
Every aspect of Tommy Wiseau's life is worth scrutiny, is my point.
Yes.
Okay.
There you go. Boy, let's go on I'm to done. The next one. Go ahead, Greg. It's a short one again.
In 1998, MTV Russia, that's right, Russia, debuts at midnight with Prodigy Live in Moscow.
Only took it to 1998 for that to finally happen. Wait, Prodigy, that's the band, right?
Yes.
That they had the...
I am the Firestarter.
Yeah, like they've got that, it's like sort of that crazy techno industrial acid rock kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that band.
Very 90s Russian, too. That was probably a good choice.
Yeah, because they love that stuff over there. There's definitely that Euro music just cracks me up.
Yeah, like industrial metal.
Let's go ahead and move on to September 27th. Jake, you're going to have to do this one because I have no idea what this is.
You have no idea what this is? All right,
no, go
fine.
Ahead.
So, 1880, the Guildhall School of Music opens in an old warehouse in South London. They attracted 62 students in their first year, but with 900 students today, it is the largest fine arts school in the United Kingdom. The Guildhall School offers courses in now music, opera, drama, and theater arts. In 2009, they opened the Center for Young Musicians, which offers education at the high school equivalency level, because they don't call it high school, you know, in the UK. It's post-primary school? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't.
I have no idea. They got their own terms. Anyway, but it offers high school level education for youths that are seeking an eventual career in fine arts. So happy 137th birthday to like the UK's version of Juilliard?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That place has probably seen some talent.
I'm
I would
sure.
say so.
I'm guaranteed.
I bet we could pull up a nice list.
Like, it's like some of those, those places you'd love to just go through the list to see, like, how many people actually made it big that came out of that school. It's like the number of people who went through Juilliard. It's just, like, astronomical, yeah. Like, how famous most of those people became. So that's
I would say that Juilliard is probably like more selective than the Guildhall is.
Well, Juilliard is also, Juilliard is world famous.
Well, yeah.
It's like, you cannot go anywhere basically in the world without it. Like, you'd be like, oh, I went to Juilliard. Oh, crap. It's like, this is a person who actually knows what they're doing. So there you go. Let's go ahead and move on, though. We're going to jump ahead a few decades. Meatloaf, 1947, is born. Marvin Lee Adey in Dallas, Texas. Meat's life is too big to cover in one podcast. I don't know what else to really say about it. If it's too much to cover for this, then I don't really know how to continue on from here.
He's okay, just then. Too big for
so,
life.
So, 1964.
Oh.
I would just say, how many things has Meatloaf been in? How many just stage productions was Meatloaf in?
I mean, like two that everyone knows.
I mean, because he was there. There's the early recordings of him, mm-hmm. like doing some basically off-Broadway kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then there's the other stuff that he did like later on. Then he did like Rocky Horror.
Yep. Speaking of Rocky Horror, yep.
Doing that.
He did Hair before that.
Yeah, he was in a bunch of crap there.
The original Broadway cast of Hair, by the way.
Yes. Then he teamed up with what's-his-name, Steinman, and produced Bat Out of Hell, which is like one of the greatest rock opera albums of all time.
It's seriously then, awesome.
Then came out with Bat Out of Hell 2,
mm-hmm.
which is equally as good, if not slightly superior. And, but on top of that, actor, singer, stage performer, fantasy football enthusiast, baseball enthusiast, never mind. This guy has just done a ton of stuff. Pretty sure he was a truck driver at some point, too. But that's
was just in a movie. I know. He never drove a truck.
He did Tenacious D. He did Fight Club.
He was in Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
Fight Club.
His small part in Tenacious D's Pick of Destiny.
Here's another tidbit for you. So before he was playing with Jim Steinman.
Yes.
Right? Did you know that he had a band that was called Meatloaf Soul that went through like three or four name changes, but one of those names actually opened for Joan Jett at the Taj Mahal?
Nice. I didn't know that.
He's been everywhere and he's kind of done almost everything but professional wrestling.
But then again, he was in Fight Club.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Meatloaf. Dun, dun,
dun, dun. See, that's kind of the funny thing, too, is that even back when he was doing the independent stage stuff, off Broadway, he was still listed as Meatloaf. And he said it came from just growing up in Texas and playing football.
Well, college football.
Yeah. So they just called him. They called him Meatloaf.
He had a coach that called him Meatloaf.
Yeah, and so the name just stuck around, and he just kept it. And so there you go. That's how we have Meatloaf today.
Also, great Meatloaf reference from the South Park episode Chef Aid. And they talk about how Chef named Meatloaf Meatloaf, and how he was almost named Couscous.
I like that. All right, let's go ahead and jump forward a bit. 1964, the Beach Boys make their TV debut on the Ed Sullivan Show by playing I Get Around.
Dude,
wow, you totally botched that.
I Get Around is my favorite one. Round, really? Round, get around, I get around.
You know what my favorite Beach Boys song is? Can you guess?
I Get Around.
No. It's not a fast one.
Good Vibrations.
Mm-mm.
Yours is probably God Only Knows.
It's going to be on Pet Sounds.
No.
Really?
In My Room.
Oh.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to.
I think my favorite is Be True to Your School.
In My Room.
Just kidding.
I don't know what it is.
They're all pretty good, though.
I don't know what it is, but there's something... there's something about In My Room that the first time I heard it, it captured my heart, man.
One of those songs. I think, honestly, my favorite Beach Boy song is probably Kokomo. Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I want to take you to Bermuda, Bahama. Come on, pretty mama.
I don't understand why the Beatles get the credit that they get for, like, their melodies and their harmonies. Like, oh, their harmonies are, like, you know, so intricate and complex. When, like, the Beach Boys, like, it, like, well, the earliest Beach Boys.
Well, we talked about how the Beach Boys album came out and the Beatles heard it and like, damn.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Beatles, you know, playing live, they could really only do a melody and then two harmonies to fit it, and which they didn't do harmonies, like, all the time. It was basically just to fill in for certain things. Even later on when they did more harmony parts, it was still just, you know, kind of balanced out like that. The Beach Boys, though, I mean, they had that five-member sound that just sounded so good. And even though the fact that, like, they didn't record any of the instruments for Pet Sounds, Brian Wilson flat out said, he's like, I need those Beach Boys vocals.
Yeah.
It's like, because that's what we're the best at. It's like, and that's what I need you guys to do. So that's why he had them come in and record all those different parts and stuff like that, and go like that. So that I've always loved the Beach Boys vocal work over the Beatles vocal work as far as intricacies go.
Here's something you've never heard anyone say before.
Go ahead.
But I'm going to describe the Beach Boys harmonies as the Lovin' Spoonful with balls.
I could see that. I could absolutely see that.
Do you guys remember, though, like the movie that came out that showed how they were, like, pitching up all of their voices for, like, a long time because they wanted them to sound younger? Because, like, the Beach Boys were all, like, almost middle-aged guys.
Yeah.
And they kind of were going for, like, the bubblegum pop tripe, you know, boy. And so they did. They would pitch up their voices
a little bit later on in their careers, or their earlier stuff, because they were teenagers when they got started.
I mean, I'd have to go back and watch.
They were
movie
in their
again.
20s. I mean, they were basically the same age as the Beatles. Like,
well,
you
now,
know, so
you know, being in your 20s is great and all, but I think they wanted to go for, like, a younger, almost like kind of teenage image, right?
Well, yeah, they were the Beach Boys, and so that's why they did all the cars and surfing and girls.
Yeah.
And then later on, they did a lot deeper stuff, you know, like the like Pet Sounds.
Once there was probably a point where they were able to cross that threshold into, like, okay, now we don't have to, like, push the young guy image because we've been around for 15 or 20
years. Well, it
was
later on in the 60s, too, so, I mean, that's why it kind of... And Brian Wilson basically just said, like, he's like, we beat the surfer thing to death.
Yeah.
So, like, it was just nonstop. Surf this, surf that, blah, 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 which was even more hilarious because only one of them could actually surf. The rest of them couldn't.
I'm going to surf your couch. Hey.
So there's that. But I wanted to close this out with a little bit of thing, too. My other favorite Beach Boys song, though, is easily Don't Worry, Baby. I actually, when I got a chance to see Brian Wilson, like, do Pet Sounds here in St. Louis, and they did Don't Worry, Baby, of which Al Jardine's, I think, his son actually is the one that sang that part, or, like, because it's got that high part, and Brian Wilson can't really do the high parts anymore. But when he sounded so much like him, it was just ridiculous, and, like, brought tears to my eyes when they did that song. And I don't know why. It's just, like, it really impacted me.
That's cool too, because the guy who sings the song was there for the concert, or no?
Brian Wilson. It was his concert. Yeah, he was there doing, like, other parts, but he can't sing those high parts, you know, because the "Don't Worry, Baby."
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm saying. Is I guess it's cool to then have, like, you know,
the son of the other Beach Boys member do that part. So
yeah, kind of keeping it in the family, but yet the guy who originally sang it was right there, but he wasn't singing it.
So. Yeah. So Al was there, the friend. He wasn't like one of the brothers. And Mike Love was their cousin. Mm. And so Al Jardine was their friend that they brought in, who could sing, and he played, you know, whatever instrument, guitar or bass. And, but yeah, his son is now singing all the high parts for Brian Wilson, like, in the band. And Al Jardine was there with him too, so.
I see.
So there you go. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. I could talk about the Beach Boys for a solid hour.
Sure.
As I've done before.
I'm going to take this because this week is my opportunity to get on the soapbox for an artist that has been ignored in recent times, and that is Curtis Blow. Because in 1980, Curtis Blow was the first rapper to perform on Soul Train. He played The Breaks, a track which, in my opinion, has
these
been...
These are the breaks.
Exactly. Has been nearly forgotten, but is as was that easily is true. As
that
influential as Rapper's Delight, or Pump Up the Volume, or...
Not Pump Up the Jams.
No, Pump Up the Volume.
Pump Up the Jams, mother!
Right. Now, the crowd at Soul Train really seemed to enjoy it. However, the host, Don Cornelius, really just didn't get it and admitted this much, saying, it doesn't make sense to old guys like me.
I always like Don Cornelius. Well, Don Cornelius.
Yeah, he's got that old-timey radio voice, you know.
Well, that was exactly what he was going for. I mean, well, that's just what he sounds like. Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, he had that
well,
deep,
okay, I take
deep
it back.
Voice.
He's got that R&B disc jockey voice.
Yeah.
Where, like, everything has to be the smoothest sound possible.
You know, he gets on the radio. He's like, the sun's gone down. Now it's time for Don Cornelius.
And all the hits are coming out.
I'll be playing the smooth sounds of R&B for you tonight while you take your lady out. That's what it sounded
right.
like to me.
Okay, but, all right, so Curtis Blow, The Breaks, was, like, crazy huge.
That it was.
And was also the first thing played on radio that had samples in it, that used an electronic sampler.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I'm going to tip my hat to Curtis Blow. Today, it sounds a little corny. The Breaks sounds a little corny. But, you know what? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I got it. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got another rapper up next.
Go for it, since you're our resident rap person.
Yay. I think I just like rap the most out of us.
I don't think so.
I want you to quote this note.
I think Brian just wants you to be the in-house rap guy.
That's fine.
Well, he knows more about rap than I do. So.
Fair enough.
And so do you, but you did the last one, so I'm letting him do this one.
The year, 1982. The place, New Orleans, Louisiana.
New Orleans.
The man... None other than Lil Wayne, born Dwayne Michael Carter Jr. That's right, Lil Wayne, the rapper. He had a contract with Cash Money Records at age 9. What?
What?
So you hear Young,
okay.
Young Money. That's Lil Wayne right there. Yeah, Lil Wayne was huge. One of his biggest brags was about being a millionaire by the time he was 25.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive. Lil Wayne, commonly associated, well, I think his biggest hit most people recognize these days would have been Lollipop.
Okay,
a lot of people
yeah.
liked Lollipop, and Mrs. Officer, and those ones all off of, what was that, the Carter 3? Carter 4? That was Carter 3. Carter
4. I do
4.
Not know.
Mm. Anyways, yeah, he also is probably one of the most famous Green Bay Packers fans, even though he's from New Orleans, and that's probably because the Packers won the Super Bowl in New Orleans in 97. And I imagine that if he's anything like me, the team that win the Super Bowl the same year that you start giving a damn about football is usually the team you like. So I always suspected that's probably why he's a Packers fan. It's because they played in New Orleans and won the Super Bowl there. So.
Makes sense.
And that's it. Happy birthday, Lil Wayne. And also, you might remember Free Weezy. He went to jail for a while and everybody said Free Weezy until he got out. That's where that came
man.
From.
I'm down with Lil Wayne. I'm cool with him.
He is good. I think he's really talented. People give him a lot of crap because he's a rapper.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people can't look further than that. But he collaborates with Kanye West a lot, you know?
That is true.
That's another one of those where I bring up Kanye a lot. But, you know, it's because Kanye is a great producer and Lil Wayne really rode the coattails of Kanye's great productions.
You know, people also talk about how he's like a Roger Corman level eye for talent, where he'll find people on YouTube, you know, like some 14-year-old in Dartmouth, Iowa.
Yeah.
You know, but I kind of wish he had some, I wish his producer game was a little bit stronger, because I'd like to see more stuff that he kind of crafted with his own hands being brought into the mainstream.
Yeah, you know, to an extent, I do feel like Lil Wayne has kind of more so been along for the ride as opposed to, like, being a real leader in the industry. Because, I mean, he's got some great music, but I do think, you know, he gets a lot of help from the producer side of things. And he's a talented rapper, and, you know, his lyrics, which is really anybody cares about in rap is, you know, your lyric game. But
Yeah, Lil Wayne is he's decent.
I want to see him get into the studio with a couple of people who like are getting left to the side. Like I'd like to see him team up with like Big Crit.
Oh yeah,
and the two of them put out an album without Wayne writing stuff, just cheerily in the studio. But maybe that's not what he wants to do, obviously, because he'd probably be doing that anyway.
Well, we'll move on here in a second, but I was going to say one of my favorite things about the rap scene and Lil Wayne is a part of, though, is that I love the whole concept of the master and the apprentice.
Yeah,
you know, the fact that every time you have a big name rapper, he brings in new people. So one of my favorite connections you can imagine is you got Dr. Dre.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dre found Eminem.
Yeah.
Eminem found 50 Cent, you know, and Eminem, you know, and then 50 Cent brought in like his people. And so it keeps going down the line, you know. I love that. Same thing. You have Notorious B.I.G.
Yeah.
And he kind of brought up Jay-Z, and then Jay-Z kind of brought up Kanye West. And then Kanye West brought up people like Lil Wayne,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it's just the fact that it's like the talent keeps being discovered and they keep bringing people into the fold.
Yeah.
And that's cool because I don't know if you hear about that as much in other genres per se.
Well, I'm sure you do in R&B. I mean, it's not as in the forefront because like you don't read 40-year-old R&B magazines, you know, but like James Brown got Bootsy Collins in the R&B game, and Bootsy Collins was a backbone of Parliament, which
mm-hmm.
then, you know, when Parliament, George Clinton wasn't George Clinton until he teamed up with Parliament, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's just kind of the fact that, and just the concept of it is great, because then you have like bands like Nirvana where, you know, somebody just went to their local club and brought in a band because they thought they were great, as opposed to like, oh my gosh, you've already been signed to a record label. At that point, it's like, well, yeah, maybe you are, you know, you might already have this on your own. So, anyways, enough about that.
Also, you can't forget that Kanye West, you know, did his duty and he made Paul McCartney famous. So,
yep, that's true.
Brought up that little guy from Liverpool. All right, let's go ahead and move on. Jake, mm-hmm. what you got?
Oh, you want me to take this one?
Yeah, go ahead and do this one.
Okay. 1986, the heavy metal world was rocked when Cliff Burton dies during a tour bus rollover while Metallica was on tour in Sweden. Many metal fans went out of their heads in excitement when they heard word that Metallica was actually doing a European tour. The word in the magazines at the time was that Metallica was just too uncompromising to crack into the mainstream, and kind of thrash metal for that matter anyway. However, with the release of Master of Puppets and a major label actually backing them, it kind of seemed like nothing could stop thrash metal from like actually cracking mainstream and taking over the world. However, the death of Burton at age 24 kind of put the brakes on the entire like LA metal scene, and they took a step backwards, and it was a few years before metal became the mainstream thing.
Mm. Interesting.
Wow. It's weird that it would take a step back,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well,
you as
think
opposed
about,
to being like yeah. celebrated and commemorated, and therefore increasing in popularity,
yeah.
you know, like most artists' deaths do nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about it. Like, so 86, we're kind of like in the middle of hair metal, right? So, you know, Poison's out. They were kind of the big thing. You had Striper
yeah.
came out and was like huge for 2 years, and then pop kind of came back in because Michael Jackson went on his huge. What was 86 was Bad, wasn't it?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
like right after that. So that kind of all went to the back seat until like the Wayne's World movie happened and that soundtrack. Okay, and then in the mid 90s, yeah, there was grunge happening and pop died, but. At the same time, there was you know, Headbangers Ball on MTV.
Yeah,
and metal actually had charts, and then there was a Grammy category for metal.
Mm-hmm.
So like that didn't happen. It was like another 4 years before that happened in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
So it just was it was just too soon, just to put it simply.
Well, for Cliff Burton, obviously.
Alrighty.
Well,
let's go ahead and jump on up to 2004. Legendary record producer Phil Spector was formally charged with murder. On February 3rd, 2003, shooting of the actress Lana Clarkson. He was convicted April 2009 and sentenced to 19 years to life in the California state prison system.
Third trial.
Yeah.
Two hung juries. He had two mistrials.
Yeah. Crazy.
Wow.
So there you go.
I think,
Phil, you are a crazy, crazy man. And I'm pretty darn sure you actually killed that person.
What's just amazing is...
Enjoy your time in prison. Thank you.
You have somebody like Phil Spector who, without murder charges and going to jail...
Mm-hmm. Just weird dude in general.
Yeah, has a very interesting life story. It's just funny to think it's like, okay, so... In addition to all that, of course you also committed murder and went to jail because why not? Like... If you've done it all, you might as well commit a crime and go to jail for the rest of your life.
I just want to know if he gets wigs in prison. Like, do they let him have wigs?
I've seen his prison photos. He doesn't get them.
Oh, he doesn't
me.
Get wigs?
No.
You sure they don't make him just take them off for the prison? I'm kidding. No. So let's, you know what? Here, let's close out the day on this. 2005, the White Stripes streamed the very first live concert ever on NPR.org.
It went a little something like this. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun. There you go. That's my impersonation of streaming.
Of trying to stream something in 2005. Yeah.
There you go.
So, hey, it wasn't like the internet wasn't a thing. It wasn't like people hadn't had concerts for you to watch. First time anyone ever was like, we're going to do internet live.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, they still do live stream musics all the time now with NPR. What do they have? What is it called? The
Tiny Desk.
The Tiny
concert?
Desk. That's it. Yep.
They post those on YouTube and stuff too. Mm-hmm. So the last actual streamed concert that I watched, though, was last year, right around Christmas time in December.
Yeah.
Live Nation streamed the Rick Astley concert in California. And if you go back to my Facebook feed at that time, I was like, I am unashamed that I am thoroughly enjoying this Rick Astley concert.
Up in the corner it says,
Up
in the corner it says, one person is watching and it's Brian Croc.
I think the last time
I bought his album that week, so. His latest album.
The very
50.
Last Tiny Desk concert that I watched recently was Mother Falcon. Anyone?
Last one I watched was Nathaniel Rateliff.
Okay. Have you seen Mother Falcon?
No.
They're amazing. They're an orchestra.
Oh, nice.
With some contemporary stuff thrown in.
Cool.
And all their singers have crazy good voices.
Nice.
That's cool. That sounds cool.
Wait, no. Was it Nathaniel? I don't remember. It was either Nathaniel Rateliff or Johnny Swim. So either one of those, just top-notch people too. But let us go ahead and move on. Greg, this one's all yours.
The day is September 28th. The year is 1901. And the man, Ed Sullivan, is born in Harlem. Happy birthday, Ed Sullivan. Before hosting the show that would introduce the youth of America to music and culture itself, Ed worked as a reporter, a sports writer, columnist, and editor for numerous publications. And like many folks in early television, he also worked in radio. Sullivan was hired as the host of a variety show called Summer Silver Theater in the year 1941. And after 7 years in radio, producer Mario Lewis, he was asked... Oh, wait, what is this?
Oh, geez. Wow, that is a terrible note.
After 7 years in radio, I think he was asked to host a variety TV show by producer Mario Lewis.
Yes.
Marlo Lewis.
Marlo. Anyways, the TV show is called Toast of the Town. The show, just like the theater it was shot in, was renamed The Ed, with Ed Sullivan in the title. So apparently he came on to a show called Toast of the Town and then basically just took over the show and it became The Ed Sullivan Show.
A really big show.
Yeah, so there was actually two sentences there that I did not cut and paste because apparently Control-C and Control-V, too difficult for me to do.
Well, I mean, we're just trying to keep the facts straight here, folks.
I love it. I mean, it really cannot be understated how impactful Ed Sullivan was on culture. I mean, hands down, he's one of the biggest things
he's
that's
like a
ever
vehicle
happened.
Of culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Same thing with like Dick Clark and I mean, even Don Cornelius doing the stuff that he did. It's like there were all these people that were always they were facilitators of the art being brought into the culture.
Yeah, can you imagine being on that level where you? Where, you know, it's one thing to be an artist who it's like, oh, another Taylor Swift song and it's a big deal. But to be the person that it's like, let's get you on my show. You play my show. You're now a celebrity. You know, like you play my show and now you got a hit single on your hands. That's a lot of power. And that's probably like I would love to be that person. Like it's like the first radio station ever. To be like, whatever we play is what you're going to hear, you know, and just, you have that power. Ed Sullivan had that power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had that influence on culture. That's amazing.
He also had that just in the industry. Like, I heard a Bob Hope story about Ed Sullivan. I don't know what year this happened, but so he runs into Ed Sullivan, like, on a Hollywood studio lot in California. Ed Sullivan is doing Ed Sullivan in New York at the time. Right. So to run into him in California was kind of weird. And he's like, oh, my God, Ed, like, what are you doing here? I didn't know you were filming something. He's like, I'm not. I just came for the soup. Like, what do you mean you came for the soup? I had the soup. You got to try it. It's
you got to try this.
It's great soup. You know, so he goes into the kitchen. Kitchen's closed. So he knocks on the door until someone who's cleaning the kitchen opens it. And Bob Hope and Ed Sullivan go into the kitchen, pull the soup out of the refrigerator and heat it up on a stovetop. Then he goes walking around with the soup in a paper cup, and they walk into the very first theater, or what's the word I'm looking for, where you shoot movies? There's a,
you know, like
studio?
A
set
studio, thank you. Or a soundstage, right? Yep. He walks in the very first soundstage there, and it's Lucille Ball, who's in the middle of recording a show, like a daytime variety show.
And he says, Lucy, you gotta try the soup.
Yes, and he comes off backstage, and Lucille's like, Ed, what are you doing here? We're trying to record. He's like, the soup, you gotta try the soup. Takes the soup, right, and gives it to a member of the audience with a spoon and says, you gotta try this, and has him pass it down the line of audience members. Now he's out of soup, so him and Bob Hope have to go back to the kitchen.
Long story short, the entire audience got an STD.
Yep, they all had cold sores after that. It was terrible.
That's what you get for sharing your soup.
Mm-hmm. However, if you got real close and you put your ear up to it like a conch shell, it sounded just like Ed Sullivan every single cold sore.
there was some truth to that story up until the jokes.
Well,
I'm going to jump in here and move on to the next fact. 1938, born on this day, Ben E. King, or Benjamin Earl Nelson, the soul and R&B singer with the Drifters, who had the 1960 U.S. number one and U.K. number two single, Save the Last Dance for Me, and but he's more well known for his song Stand By Me, which he actually wrote for somebody else, and then they didn't want to do it, and then he was like, okay, fine, I'll record it. But he always talked about it because the song wasn't actually written like in his proper key, and so he preferred to sing lower songs. He preferred to sing bass, like in, you know, groups, and so it was kind of funny because here he is having to sing this higher sort of tenor part, but he nailed it.
Yeah, that song is just nothing but a classic. It's weird to think that he wasn't comfortable with it too.
Yeah,
you know, because it sounds great. It's
he was fine with it later on. I mean, he always thought that it was, like, you know, the best thing that he did, and he was always happy to perform the song. Never, I mean, he was one of these guys that always had a smile on his face. You know, he always seemed to be happy. Just to, it's like, man, I get paid to sing in front of people. This is the greatest job ever.
Wow.
So, unfortunately, he died not too long ago, April 30th, 2015. He was 76.
Wow. Well, happy birthday, Benny King.
There you go, guy. Did good.
Mm.
Go ahead, Jake. You're itching to do this one.
I know. I think it's time for News in the Weird.
News in the Weird.
I don't know. I think I should come up with a more original title than that. But this is the strange news story for the week.
Jake's Weird News Story of the Week.
It's time to get weird with Jake.
I love it. All right.
Time for story time with Creepy Jake.
Watch out. Here comes Jake. It's getting weird.
Jake. There were normal facts don't intrigue the man. He has to find the strange ones that bend your ear.
It's weird.
All right.
It's getting weird in here.
All right, how many drops can we actually do for shock jocks? Like, did how many can we create?
I don't know why, but I just flashed into the, Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
Mr. Meeseeks.
Mr. Meeseeks.
It's like we've been out here too long and things are getting weird.
Mr. Meeseeks, make things weird. Go can do.
All right, well, here we go.
Go for it.
1943. Klaus Karl Kassebaum is born in Plauen, Schleswig-Holstein, Germany.
Wow, that was good.
While still an infant, Klaus's family was forced to flee Germany after Operation Valkyrie. His father was an officer in the Kriegsmarine and involved in the failed assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler. Fearing reprisal, and with a lot of help from the Allies, might I add, they relocated to Toronto. Klaus's family then changed their surnames, and he became Nick St. Nicholas. In 1967, during a show at the Whiskey A Go Go, John Kay and Jerry Edmonton asked Nick to rejoin them in Steppenwolf, where he became again the principal songwriter.
Wow, Steppenwolf. There's kind of the twist to the story.
Yeah.
Is that Klaus Karl Kassebaum from Plauen, Schleswig, Holstein, Germany?
Schleswig-Holstein.
It's funny because
you gotta be German to say this, okay?
Well, it's funny because I study German, and even I'm just like half-assing my way through it. Schleswig. Yeah.
Schleswig-Holstein.
Yeah, well, hey, like all of these are missing umlauts and s-sets.
That's
so,
true.
You know,
was gibt's?
So, Jake.
Was is good.
All right, we got to jump ahead 20 years here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who this actually is.
Really?
But I'll go ahead and read it.
Mm-hmm.
So 1963, Murray the K plays the Beatles' She Loves You for the first time on American airwaves.
Yes.
You're going to have to explain this one just a little bit more than that.
Okay.
Well, go for it.
Murray the K is another one of the many people who has a claim to the title of the fifth Beatle.
Oh, okay.
So Murray the K was a DJ.
Yes.
Right. And he hung out with the Beatles, loved the Beatles, and kind of shepherded them around for like the first few months in the U.S.
Okay. See, now, the way that this note reads, that Murray the K was a band or an artist that then played the Beatles song.
Yes. Okay.
On the airwaves for the first time. Like, they got a hold of it before America did. And they were like, we're going to perform this right now. Let's go.
See, I could, in edit.
That's what that made it sound like. You didn't, because if it was a DJ, then that makes a lot more sense.
See, if I was an actual producer, I would have, like, reread all of these and I would go, oh, that should say DJ, disc jockey, Murray the K.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
DJ Murray the K.
I like it, though. That's pretty good. Plays She Loves You for the first time on American airwaves. All right, we're going to jump forward to 1974. Bad Company goes to number one on the U.S. album chart with their self-titled debut album.
Paul Rodgers,
Simon Kirk, who had just come out of Free while Mick Ralphs played the guitar with Mott the Hoople. See, now that's Murray the K, Mott the Hoople. And Boz Burrell was the bass player for King Crimson before the group formed in 1973. Very much like this sort of power group, you know, that was just formed of like all these other band members. But they produced six albums together before disbanding in 1983. And of course, everyone knows their self-titled album and self-titled song, Bad Company.
By Bad Company.
By from Bad the Company. Album. From the album Bad Company. Company. Bad Company! Till the day I die. Bad Company.
Mott the Hoople and King Crimson were both kind of like stoner rock jazz bands.
Yeah.
Or jam bands.
Yeah, I was just thinking how the list of names from this story is the total of it sums up to a lot of good music because Free is a great band, Mott the Hoople, and then of course Bad Company, like these guys branched out pretty far and brought us some great music.
You know, also, Murray the K and Mott the Hoople kind of sound like name drops from a Tom Waits song.
That's true.
Yeah. I was hanging out with Mott the Hoople. He was trying to get me a pooper scoople.
All right, let's move on.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Go ahead, Greg. You can read this one.
1987. Dyslexia strikes again. The Sun reports that Elton John had his dog's larynxes surgically removed. That's a big deal. The reason? Because they would not bother him because they couldn't bark. But the story is completely untrue. Elton John would actually file suit for defamation, and this resulted in a £1 million settlement and an apology, which I feel like is probably rare and I would frame, but an apology on the front page of The Sun. Now, granted, I don't know about 1987, but I do know growing up in the 90s, The Sun was kind of like the National Enquirer, which is essentially all of it was just pure BS.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And so I don't know if they had that reputation back then or if maybe this was kind of a catalyst for that, but
I will tell you this. I am completely, totally, 100%, wholeheartedly against the removing of dogs' larynxes to stop them from barking.
Because then they just sound like rodents.
Yeah. It is beyond cruel, as far as I'm concerned.
That's a thing. Like,
yeah,
I've never.
And
heard
in
of
fact,
it.
there was recently a court case that happened that I saw, where a couple is being forced to remove their dog's larynx because their neighbor sued them.
That's
because
right.
The dog was barking all the time.
I heard that as well. Yeah,
and it was just like. It was completely ridiculous, but I honestly hope that instead of doing that, they did something, you know, it's like, I don't care if it's illegal at that point. You do what you have to do to save that dog. Like, because that's just, it's cruel. It's just cruel.
It does seem cruel to take away a dog's ability to bark, you know? But, I mean, we also take away their ability to reproduce. And with cats, we take away their claws, and
I'm not really big on declawing cats,
you know,
either.
It's just
and actually, I'm
how,
kind of against, you know, like the neutering and spaying of animals.
Well,
too,
you're a silly person then.
Moral of the story, though,
if Bob Barker endorsed it, it's morality.
No,
thank
that's
you.
Not true.
The moral of the story, though, is that human.
I understand
beings,
why he did it, but at the same time, it still is just like,
yeah.
I noticed the difference in my dog when we had him neutered. That's all I'm saying.
It's noticeable.
Yeah. It's now half an animal. You're right.
Well, not half an animal. It's just that you took something that was part of that dog's natural process.
When we neutered our cat, he just, you know, once the cat got neutered, he was like a lazy cat. Before we neutered him, he was like a crazy cat. You know? I mean, it was just that 180 switch. But all I was going to say, though, is it goes to show that human beings are more inclined to just do what's convenient for us.
Yep.
In a lot of cases. You know, so, I mean, you could be a responsible pet owner and you could not allow your dog to fornicate without your supervision. But instead, we could just remove the dog's reproductive organs entirely and then we just have to not worry about it. And I really don't take a stance on that other than to say that we clearly found it more convenient to just remove a body part than take any responsibility.
True.
Anyways.
All right, I'm done with that.
Yeah.
Enough
that
just
about
makes
that.
Me angry. Yeah. So.
Well, anyway, The Sun's a tabloid, and anybody that works for that magazine
I'm
is
I'm very happy
asshole.
that turned out not to be true.
Yeah.
And actually, I do know Elton John is very big into animal rights and that kind of stuff. He may go a little bit far. I'm pretty sure he's like all under the PETA and stuff like that, too. But like, I just... I don't go that far, but still.
Anyhow.
Go for it.
Oh, here we go. 1997, the DVD-A turns 20. Well, it turns 20 today. And in 1997, the audio format was introduced at the Audio Engineer Society. It was 3 years before the disc were available to consumers, and there was a brief format war between DVD-A and Super Audio CD, but by 2007, DVD-A was off the shelves and effectively extinct. Does anyone other than me remember this.
I don't.
No.
Really?
I remember VHS Beta.
Yes.
And I remember like laser discs.
Okay. Well, okay, we're okay. So DVD A was just an audio format on a DVD.
Okay, well, that seems like a lot of wasted space, considering you can put like 4 gigs on a
DVD. That's exactly the point.
Is that kind of like, are those like kind of like the smaller CDs they had?
No.
That you could put MP3s on a CD?
Well, okay, no. All right, so there's mini disc, right?
Yeah.
Now, there are DVD mini discs. There's also CD format mini disc, right? Which those are different media formats. DVD-A was an audio format for a way of putting sheer audio on a DVD media. So you could have 4 gigs on a playable disc on a DVD-A player.
That's why I thought it was like a mini disc.
Okay.
Because you could fit so much on a disc that was smaller than a CD.
Yeah. For a while, it kind of seemed like DVD-A might be the new DJ format. But then like hard drives just got so immense, like so cheap to put just, you know, MP3 or even WAV files on.
Yeah.
You know, because you can get a 2 terabyte hard drive now for $60.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
This reminds me a lot of the whole HD DVD versus Blu-ray as well. The more recent thing where we all know now that Blu-ray clearly won that competition.
Well, I think, okay, so DVD-A was backed by Sony, and I think Super Audio CD was backed by Panasonic.
Ooh.
So,
Couple of heavy hitters.
Yeah. All right. So no one but me remembers it, and that's the end of the story.
Well, that's because the consumer decides, and we decided to ignore it and go by the wayside. So, and I think that brings us to a whole new day.
September 29th. Born on this day in 1907, Gene Autry, America's singing cowboy. During his career, Autry scored 25 successive top 10 country hits. Unfortunately, Gene Autry died the 2nd of October, 1998, age 91.
Nice, ripe old age.
Yes, he lived a good long time.
America's singing cowboy.
That's all I got. Jake, what's next?
I do not lament the death of the singing cowboy as, like, a thing. But anyhow.
That's you.
That's me. All right, 1948, Mark Farner is born in Flint, Michigan. Mark is the frontman for Grand Funk Railroad, who hit number one with We're an American Band on September 29th, 1973, Mark's 25th birthday.
Wow. Okay, first off, he was 25. Dang. Second of all, We're an American Band is like my favorite karaoke song to sing.
We're an American Band!
Yeah, I love Grand Funk Railroad, so that's a good one. I'm happy about that. But I'm a little surprised to know that great, great song was sung by a man who was only 25 years old. Just changed his perspective on everything.
I want to say Grand Funk was like his like fifth or sixth band he was in.
Really?
Yeah, he was touring with a few different bands like when he was 19. So,
you know, honestly, you can't undersell Grand Funk Railroad either because they did have a lot more great hits. I remember when they had The Locomotion and, of course, Some Kind of Wonderful, which is like my song with me and my girlfriend. So that's a good one. Well, here's another birthday coming up in 1963. None other than legendary bass player Les Claypool is born in Richmond, California. Les Claypool, of course. As well as his solo stuff, is widely known as the lead singer and bass player and creative genius behind Primus. And also, for those of you who don't listen to Primus, you may have heard him also produce the theme song for South Park. Les Claypool as well. What a great bass player, man.
Mm-hmm.
We would certainly love to do another Primus podcast, you know, and I think if you want to hear more about Les Claypool, I would recommend did you guys do Sailing the Sea of Cheese? Was that it?
No, we did not
Frizzle Fry. You did Frizzle Fry, didn't you? Okay, so we have a Frizzle Fry album review that if you want to hear more about Les Claypool and the band, it might save yourself some trouble if you just go check out that podcast as well. So happy birthday, Les Claypool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. 1969, Merle Haggard releases Okie from Muskogee, a Vietnam War protest song that later on hit number one on the country music charts, proving that even Redneck hated the Vietnam conflict.
Yeah, something about war just rubs people the wrong way.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's generally what kind of happens. I mean, there's not a lot of people who write, like, pro-war songs.
Yeah, interesting.
Honestly, kind of everyone in country music during the Bush administration.
Well, it was kind of like pro-war, well, but no, it wasn't,
no,
though.
It was a lot of support the troops. It was not a lot of... I mean, the only one that I remember that was even remotely like that was the Have You Forgotten song. Have you forgotten when those towers fell? Like that song. I don't even remember who it was.
Yeah.
But it was basically just like, you know, it's like we're going to go and like kick butt in all these other countries that like did this crap to us and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So like I can remember that, but I don't remember another song coming out that was just like, we're going to go to Vietnam and kill everybody.
That is funny because... We'll put a boot up your ass. That's the American way.
Damn it, Greg.
And Uncle Sam.
I was just going to Google. I just Googled the lyrics for Toby Keith's song, courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue.
Yeah, I do remember that one, too.
Okay.
So. That doesn't count, though, because that didn't come out during the Bush administration, did it?
And the Statue of Liberty started
shaking. Came out afterwards, right?
That was definitely right after 9/11.
That one wasn't.
That song?
When did that come out?
I mean, it could have been maybe a year or two or three, but it was definitely like a 9/11 response.
2002.
Really?
There you go.
2002.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because we were mad.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. We were mad.
I mean, you know, it's 9/11.
You are correct. 2002.
All right.
Yeah,
then.
I was wrong.
So there you go, pro-war music, country music, early 2000s.
That's two kinda. Songs.
That's very borderline. Mm-hmm.
Well, there were imitators that came out after the Toby Keith song. There were plenty of them. Now, I'll say not all of them charted. A lot of them you would find on cassette tapes and truck stops, but they were still there. Yeah.
True.
Anyhow.
Like a CD that just says, like, 100% pure American rock. And it's like a compilation with a bunch of songs you haven't really heard. Before.
Yeah. I dig it.
Anyhow, this might be your pick, Brian, for the strangest story of the week.
Yes, I do know that. Because I read it and I laughed.
Yeah, all right.
When I was checking stuff out earlier.
Yeah.
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I don't care who does it, but it requires radio voice.
Okay. 1976, on September 29th, Jerry Lee Lewis is celebrating his 41st birthday like many of us do by hanging a soda can from an office door and shooting it with a .357 Magnum. Jerry is highly amused. Not amused at all is the man standing behind the door, that man being his bass player, Norm Owens. Lewis is later charged with unlawfully discharging a firearm in city limits, and Norm recovers with two bullet wounds in his chest. After calling Lewis on the phone to quit the band, he then fired back with one large caliber lawsuit.
Gotcha.
And he paid up.
Oh, yes, he did.
Lewis totally had to pay up for that one.
Mm-hmm.
How does, man...
And
he got shot twice in the chest. And they said in the chest.
With a Magnum.
That's not like the shoulder. Right. That's not the arm. That's in the chest. And so how in the freaking world did he survive that?
Must have been one hell of an office door.
God. Jerry Lee Lewis is very lucky.
He must have slowed it down just enough.
And in classic Jerry Lewis fashion, which in parentheses is asshole fashion, for years after that. He would start his concerts by saying, this show's brought to you by Norm Owens, saying he had to go on tour to pay off the lawsuit.
Oh. Whatever. Yeah. He's bitter, but who cares?
Yeah, I mean, you shot a guy.
Yeah,
you
but at the same time, screw Jerry Lee Lewis. Dick.
Yeah.
Can't stand that dude. I honestly, like, it's gotten to the point now where it's like I'm so just... annoyed if anybody even brings up Jerry Lee Lewis. It's like, I was just like, really? We should not be remembering this man fondly at all.
No.
So, but I think that's all we got for that one. Who wants to do the next one? Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's funny. I actually remember this song.
So do I.
From digging it out of my parents' like record collection. I don't know how to pronounce the name of this band, but I do remember listening to the song a lot. The number one song in America this day in 1977 was a disco remix of the Star Wars theme and that Cantina band. And the band who did it now, are they called Miko?
I want to say Miko.
I don't know, but it might be Mecco because Mecco was also a toy company.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a band or just like a corporation.
It doesn't help that they're kind of like a one-hit wonder.
Well, that's true.
Except they had like two hits, but it you know, the gimmick to it. So anyways, M-E-C-O, that's the band. Billed as Galactic Funk, which is how I was familiar with it, was that they referred to it as Galactic Funk. They also disco glittered The Empire Strikes Back, so they definitely find their groove with the Star Wars disco. It was the 80s, and America hated disco. But I hear it was big in Poland.
There you go. I do remember that song, because they love to bust it out.
Yeah.
Like when they're doing sort of flashbacks to the Star Wars-y, you know, stuff. Mm. Like,
that is a cool song,
the
though,
one
too.
I've always got stuck in my head, though, is... the one actor doing the Star Wars song on Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray.
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars.
Yeah. I don't know, man. The R2-D2 beeps that are thrown into that disco remix are actually, like, pretty solid. Like, they use that to a great effect. Anyway.
This next one's definitely you again, Jake.
Oh, I know it is. I know it is. Because on this day, in 1980... Curtis Blow released his self-titled album, Curtis Blow. It was the first rap album that was backed by a major label, and it sold very well for Mercury Records with nearly 800,000 copies, and since then, of course, it's gone platinum, you know, but
wow.
Nobody cares about calling the record platinum like 2 months after the release or a year after release, you know?
Well, yeah, because it's, I mean, with enough time, mm-hmm. you would hope that you would reach those levels, but 1980, very early for that. But that's awesome that you got picked up and supported by a major label. So, and it sold well, so it must have been popular.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about the fact that, like, rap was just something that was done in clubs at the time. You know, Curtis Blow was the only rapper on the radio. This is really even, like, pre-Grandmaster Flash.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we had to get over disco somehow. So.
Fair enough, and Curtis Blow is a decent way to do it. I have
you know
a
what
lot
the best way,
him.
Though, was still getting a bunch of disco records at a stadium and then blowing it up.
Blowing them up. Well, we only have one interesting fact left.
That
and,
is true.
This one has always been a really interesting one. Just kind of the story behind it, but who's doing it? You want...
Jake?
Go ahead.
Okay, Greg, you go ahead and do it.
Ooh, okay. Well, in 2011, Sylvia Robinson dies at age 75 with congestive heart failure. Now, she's called the mother of hip-hop, and for good reason, she founded Sugar Hill Records, who, of course, brought us the Sugar Hill Gang and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, which, of course, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. The influence of Rapper's Delight and The Message cannot be overstated because it then defined what rap was in the earliest days of the genre. And it has been debated that Rapper's Delight is the first ever rap song.
Recorded.
Fair enough.
You know.
First ever rap song recorded.
Yeah, well,
yes. At the same time, there were bootleg tapes of Grandmaster Flash back before that. It's just that was bootleg.
Yeah.
And so like the first time that they ever actually like had a, you know, hey, we're going into a recording studio and we're going to actually record a rap song for an album, this is what it's going to be. And yet like they didn't use samples at all. They used actual band to record those. So
a really great current reference to all of this is the Netflix series The Get Down.
Yes.
Great series, actually.
Yeah, it's so good.
Unfortunately, it won't continue. They didn't renew it for another season.
Oh, really?
It was really awesome.
But it
though.
Was and actually the music in it was super, super good.
But it's funny because you were talking about the Grandmaster Flash bootleg going around, and that's kind of like the plot of the show.
Yeah.
Is that the Grandmaster bootleg?
Yeah.
you know, gets nabbed and is being bootlegged, as you can imagine. So that kind of ties into this. But
I still love the end of the first season when they do that song on the stage, and they got that like that hook of the song. It's like, Shaolin's the DJ that we call conductor, because Shaolin Fantastic's a bad mother.
Yeah, that was, dude, it was sick. But back to Sylvia Robinson. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with this, maybe even know better than I do. But the story essentially goes that she really liked rap. She really wanted to get something recorded because she had just, you know, had the ability to get stuff recorded. And so she wanted to kind of assemble a team. So I remember like when she put together Sugar Hill Gang, it was like, do you know anybody who can rap? And they were like, well, you know, like my buddy who works at the pizza shop, raps sometimes. And so she got people together that weren't even really necessarily good rappers in the rap scene, but just rappers that were accessible to her personally. And so she had them come in and just do this stuff. And it was just a beat from a song that she just wanted looped continuously forever. And if you listen to Rapper's Delight, it's basically like the first minute of the song as it builds, and then it goes and it just repeats, and that's it the whole time. But yeah, that kind of sparked it all after that. And I think it's just kind of funny to think that it was guys that weren't really in the rap game who kind of pioneered the rap game for actual rappers, which could almost be considered extremely insulting.
I just realized I totally like misspoke when I said that the breaks from Curtis Blow predated. I meant overshadowed. Like, to just wrong
I get
word.
I get what you mean.
Sylvia Robinson was a recording artist before she became a producer, and her husband Joe Robinson was an R&B producer. So that was kind of their inroad to get studio time and get some, I mean, she paid for everything to get the to get the Sugar Hill Gang in studios. You know what? I'm just glad that Sylvia Robinson was a fan of rap.
Yeah.
Because not saying the rap would not be a genre of music today if it wasn't for her, just it probably would have taken a lot longer.
I said a hip hop. A hip to the hip to the hip, hip hop, and you don't stop a rocking to the bang bang boogie to the double to the boogie to the beat.
Something like that.
Now, what you hear is not a test. Anyways, that was the end of our show.
That is the end of our show, and it's the longest show we've done so far, despite the fact that we had fewer facts to go through. Oh, yeah. We just hit the hour 52 minute mark.
Oh, buddy.
And we haven't closed out the show just yet. So I will do so now. Thank you for listening to Follow the Sound. I would also like to thank Lineup Media for allowing us to do the show. You can go to lineupmedia.fm and find all of our other great podcasts out there, because statistically speaking, if you're listening to ours, you will listen to other podcasts as well. So go find them and find all the great podcasts on our network at lineupmedia.fm. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. This, of course, has been Follow the Sound. Along with me has been my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Adios.
And Greg Harvey.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.